Right. Today is the 25th of February, 2009. I'm with Manzoor Hassan, the director of the Institute of Governance Studies at BRAC University at their offices in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Before we start the interview, Mr. Hassan, could I ask that you've given your consent for this interview?
Yes, I have.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Now, before we talk about civil service reform and administrative reform in Bangladesh, I wonder if you could just tell me what your current responsibilities are at IGS and some of the positions that you've held in the past that have brought you up to this position.
Well, as you've said earlier on, I'm the director of the Institute. I was involved with the Institute. Since its inception, which was, what, now 3.5 years back. Officially, I was not the first director. I was the international director, but I was involved from the very first day. We appointed a former cabinet secretary as the first director of the institute. But after he left, that was around 2000. October of 2006 that I took over, and I've been the director ever since. Prior to that, I was the executive director of Transparency International Bangladesh. I was the founding executive director of Transparency International Bangladesh when it started its work in 1996, and I was the executive director for 7 years, and then I left TI Bangladesh and went to Berlin to be the regional director for Asia Pacific, and did that for a year, and then returned to Bangladesh and joined BRAC and BRAC University. I'm by profession, by training, a lawyer.
All right, and most of this interview will revolve around the civil service in Bangladesh, some of its challenges and some of the reform efforts that have been attempted. I wonder, could you talk about the issues and challenges currently facing the civil service?
The civil service that we have, the structure of the civil service is still very much the one that was left behind by the colonial power. So we have a very hierarchical structure, I think certainly this is a major challenge for the bureaucracy, particularly given the fact that the nature of the business that the civil service is involved in has changed dramatically over the last 50-60 years since the partition of the Indian subcontinent. So I would say that this is a major challenge that we are facing. Secondly, I would say that, you know, the fact that the people who in the system, the way they are trained and the way they are given their instructions to operate, still is is a lot to be desired. Because the training that they receive, I feel, is not adequate to perform the kind of duties they're supposed to be performing. So it's both, I would say, the structural sort of challenge and the software challenge, which I would highlight to be the major sort of obstacles that I think people in the civil service are faced with. I don't think that we can describe the civil service in a monolithic manner, that everybody in the service is thinking negatively or not have the right mindset. But I suspect that it's the system which forces a lot of them to behave in the way that they behave. Particularly given our experience with the master's program, that we are now doing, where we have mid-career civil servants undertaking the MA program. We find that a lot of these people started the working life with a different set of attitude, but has changed. But that set of attitude has changed over a period of time.
What is this? What is the master's degree?
The master's degree is known as the master's MA in governance and development. It's a 12-month full-time, 12-month program, where we have. It is a residential program, and every year we take 25 students as our students, and they are all from the civil service, from the public sector, and this is because of an arrangement that we have with the government, whereby they give us some names, more than 25 names. Generally, we are talking about a couple of hundreds, and from those names, we then select 25.
And how do you go about selecting the 25 from the hundreds of names you receive?
We have a three-tier selection process. We ask them to sit for a simple written test. We try to find out what the level of English, and then we do a group interview where they have to discuss a particular topic and interact with each other, and try to basically sort of make a good case out of their own points of view. And finally, the final tier is that of individual interview, where the individual applicants have to face a panel of interviewers, and then have to satisfy them. So it's the aggregate of those three tests that would determine whether the person gets a place or not.
And does everybody, do all the people who are suggested by the government go through all of the all three stages?
Certainly the written one, and then after the written test, we basically discard quite a large number, and then the final two tiers, all of them will be going through those who remain, and then the final decision is taken on the basis of the group interview and the individual interview.
And so I understand, I presume that the course is taught in English.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And it's taught here at IGS?
It's taught at IGS, but our residential program is not based here. We use the campus of Brack University, where the students stay and undertake the different courses of the master's program.
What sort of things are you looking for in the candidates?
We are basically looking for people who are prepared to take risk by coming to a program like this and foregoing 1 year of work, and also probably, possibility of promotion. They have to spend that year. For some people, this could even be foregoing some financial incentives. Secondly, I think we are looking for people who are prepared to also think outside the box in terms of the way they want to operate, the kind of relationship that they want to build with their customers, if I can put it this way, basically people who are wanting to learn new ideas, which they would then be able to go out and implement. And I think we are also looking for people who are are thinking of taking a leadership position in terms of reform, governance reform, or reform even within their own establishment. So we're looking for change agents, basically, because we feel that you know, if one wants to actually bring about governance change, then one has to work with the public sector, and within the public sector, we need to identify people who would be able to bring about changes. So it's one, I would say, identifying individuals. Second, I would say, how you link up those individuals over a period of time, so that there's a network which would then be able to bring about the kind of the critical mass that sometimes we talk about, you know, within that particular institution. So it's a number issue, and also at the same time, I think building a network over a period of time, which would be able to bring about the kind of changes that we are looking for.
And how does the government go about selecting? What sort of people does the government typically suggest?
Hello. Andrew, I'm at the interview. Te, apne ki aachen kichu kon? Okay, I'm sheshu la apne kame bolbo. Ji, thank you. Bye.
So,
yes.
Start again. How does the government go about choosing the people it suggests, and what sort of level are they in the civil service?
The government, what they do is, once we inform the Ministry of Establishment that we are ready to recruit a new batch of students, they issue letters to different ministries, saying that they nominate people who would be interested in doing this particular program, and then the different ministries and departments, they do their own, go through their own process of identifying people, and then a list is sent to the Ministry of Establishment, and those lists are then consolidated, and the names are given to us. I suspect the Ministry of Establishment will probably not, they probably don't give us the full list. They have their own sort of vetting and selection process. This may be to do with age, this may be to do with whether they have had this kind of academic exposure in the past. So I suspect that is something that happens. But what we try to do is, we make it very clear to the Minister of Establishment that we would like a very wide cross-section of people applying. So it should not be just one particular cadre, for example, the administrative cadre. That it should, the list should contain people from the different sections of the civil service. Also, we make it very clear to them that it should have a gender balance. So there should be a good number of female candidates, as part of that list that we receive. So that's how it happens.
How did you go about developing the curriculum for the training for this master's?
Well, when we were negotiating with the government, we initially had the idea of doing short courses, executive courses. But the government made it very clear that their preference would be to have a master's program rather than short courses. And I think their argument was that it's very difficult to bring about changes within one's thinking, with short courses. It is much better to have a master's program over a period of 12 months. And I can see their argument in that. And so when we decided with the government that it will be a master's program, we then invited Well, initially we visited a number of overseas universities, included universities such as National University of Singapore, the University of Malay, the Monash in Australia, Griffith in Australia, Harvard in the United States, IDS, Institute of Development Studies, Sussex University, Bath, and a few others. So I visited those universities, identified people who would be interested, and we then decided on a curriculum workshop where we invited some of these people from these universities, and also we invited people from academicians from local universities, including Barak University, and also some senior civil servants, you know, and organized a 3-day workshop with all of them participating, and basically the curriculum came out of that workshop, the first draft, and basically we built on that, and the curriculum that we have is the product of that exercise. But over the years, last few years, some modifications have been made to that curriculum. But generally, it has remained what was decided at that workshop, which took place in the year 2005 in the month of August.
And what does that curriculum include?
The curriculum basically includes two sections. One, the core courses, and then the second section are the elective courses. And the whole course has a credit of 36 points, basically. And out of those 36 points, 9 credits are devoted to a dissertation that students will have to write, and the remaining points are basically courses that people take. And if I'm not mistaken, out of the remaining credit points, so 36 minus 9, 12 are made up of core courses, and the remaining points are made up of elective courses. Now, with core courses, you'll see there's some courses like economics for public leadership, learning from people, and the leading issues of governance in Bangladesh are some, for example, are some of those core courses. And under the elective courses, we have subjects like ethics, corruption, international law, public policy, and few more. Yeah.
Right. And the training and the teaching is done by members of Barak University?
Not totally. We have faculty from within Barak University. We have faculty from outside Barak University. We also get faculty from outside Bangladesh. So it's a kind of a wide range of people that we try to get who come and teach. And we try to make it international, because we feel that, you know, it is beneficial for the students that they are exposed to faculty with different kind of teaching skills.
What sort of things do the participants typically choose for their dissertations?
Normally, they go for subjects which they are presently involved with, or they worked on prior to coming to the course. So, for example, you know, most of the time, we find that people are writing on issues like local government, revenue collection, environmental issues, the role of NGOs in the development process, the problems that civil servants confront, you know, in their work. These are some of the kind of the topics that we find that people sort of go for. I would say that, you know, it is supposed to be an exercise where people actually document their experience, and also something that that they want to pursue, you know, in both in terms of academic work and also converting that into a practical project.
So what is, have you been able to test the results of your program, the outcomes on the civil servants who've gone through?
Well, I mean, if you're looking at the change in mindset, I think, you know, I would say that, you know, we're still in early days, and I feel that, you know, to have that kind of to bring about that kind of change or to see that kind of outcome, I think, you know, it'll be far too early to say that has been the achievement, and I think that, you know, I mean, this is also something which is very difficult to document. We have undertaken evaluation at the end of the first year.
When was the first year?
The first year was around September of 2006, and an evaluation was done. But that evaluation was more to do with how the course is running rather than the kind of impact that the course is having on the civil servants. It was more to do with the fine tuning of the course after the end of first year. We are thinking of doing another evaluation at the end of the third year, which is the current year, and again, we would like to see whether the curriculum needs to be changed. But also, I think this time we would also like to see whether it is producing the kind of results that we would like to see, you know, coming out from an exercise of this kind. I suspect, you know, I mean, what would be useful to look at now would be to see the you know, the kind of the extent of the network of these graduates who are coming out of this master's program, whether they are benefiting from this network, whether they are actually making good use of that, of the network, and to what extent that these people, these graduates, have been able to you know, place themselves in some strategic postings and positions from where they could help to improve the governance situation of Bangladesh. So I think, you know, we haven't yet finalized the terms of reference. We're in the process of doing that, and then we will undertake the evaluation. In terms of fundamental change within the civil service, my feeling is that it is still too early to expect something like that to happen. I also feel that for the students who finish our program and they go back to the system, and when they go back to the system, it is important to see whether they are getting the kind of support that they would require to really to bring about those fundamental changes. So what, you know, what kind of cooperation are they getting from their line managers? Whether they've been given due recognition for the for the new skills and knowledge that they've acquired. These are also issues probably we need to find out when we do the evaluation of the program that has been running for the last 3 years. I suppose, you know, as I said earlier on, the issue of number is very important to bring about a fundamental change. At the moment, we've got 50 people who have finished this program. We've got 25 more who are now currently doing this program. We feel that in order to bring about a fundamental change, this number has to increase. And with that in mind, we are now discussing with the government whether they would be able to give us some financial assistance in order to increase the number from, say, 25 to 50.
So where do you get your current funding from, and who pays for the courses that the civil servants take?
Well, when the program started, it was underwritten by BRAC. But at the same time, we applied for funding to different donors. And the Dutch government came forward pretty quickly with $1.5 million for 3 years. And that also would require some additional funding from BRAC. So the work that we have been doing, the master's program that we have been doing over the last 3 years, has been funded by the Dutch government. The bulk of it has come from the Dutch government. And now we are seeking. We initially did not ask the government of Bangladesh to contribute, mainly because of the fact that we wanted to operate independently, and to actually to take our own decisions regarding certain policy issues. So now we feel that, you know, after 3 years, that, you know, we are in a position where we can afford to take funding, accept funding from the government. And we also feel that, you know, this is important. Government funding from government source is important in order to develop a sense of ownership for this particular government, for this particular course. If they really want this course to continue. If they don't, then I think, you know, it shouldn't continue, and shouldn't depend on funding from a donor.
So one of the things that I've encountered while I've been here is a great willingness and interest that the government has in providing or in training opportunities with the reforms as the goal, as the outcome. So reform-minded people. But there seems to be a lack of interest in the government implementing reforms from the center. Why do you think this is the case? Do you think, or why is the government not implementing its own reforms and instead focusing on these development programs?
I would say that this is mainly because of the fact that there isn't the kind of political leadership that is required to bring about fundamental reform within the system, you know, whether it's public service or any other system. If the political leadership is not ready, then they are not. We're really not sure what we want to do. If you don't know what we want to do, then basically, you know, you accept money from any donor to undertake a reform program or training program, and it really becomes a matter of spending money and ticking the boxes and satisfying mainly, I suspect, the agenda of the donor community, rather than bringing about fundamental changes within the system. So I would say, the reason that I would cite for this is the lack of political leadership, lack of political vision, you know, in terms of the direction that the country should take.
So considering this, what sort of chances are there of the alumni of your program having an impact if there isn't some impetus of reform? Do you think that having enough reform-minded people in the civil service will have an effect?
Well, the way we look at it is this, that there's very little that one can do as an academic institution to generate political vision or reform or leadership or political leadership. I mean, this is something which will have to come through a political process. But we feel that we are in a strong position to actually, train people who would become essential when there is that political vision and political leadership. Because when you have the political vision and the political leadership, they would require competent civil servants, you know, to do this kind of work, to take charge of the kind of reform agenda that they would come up with. So basically, what we are saying is that, you know, that rather than not doing anything, that we actually invest in training people and creating and therefore create a pool of people who would be ready to take up the challenge when the political leadership is ready to move forward. And in a way also, I mean, if there is a pool of trained individuals, people who are prepared to take leadership and also be entrepreneurial, then I think political leadership may also feel encouraged to move forward and sort of take certain steps which would sort of take us away from the present path and sort of give us a new sense of direction. You know, it's sometimes there is this catch-22 situation that, you know, what would vision do if you don't have the people? But then sometimes you have the people, but you don't have the vision. I suppose, you know, one doesn't know which one's going to come first, but at least we feel that we as an institution should be in a position to produce properly trained civil servants, particularly as we are interested in the public sector, but also probably to some extent also trained people in the private sector who would be able to take up the challenges in the future.
So thinking about that, one of the things that I've been a little confused about in Bangladesh is the relationship between politicians and civil servants, especially senior civil servants. Some people have said that politicians rely heavily on civil servants, that ministers rely heavily on their secretaries because they are more experienced. Other people have said that secretaries and senior civil servants are moved from ministry to ministry at the whim of politicians, and that the senior civil service is reluctant to stand up to politicians. What is that dynamic like, and how does that affect the attempts at reform, or the likelihood of reform?
I think there are a number of issues here. First, I would say that I think we have to look back a bit to understand this. Despite the fact that, you know, we have a civil service which is, you know, which is pretty archaic, going back to the British days, you know, the kind of the ethos that they have, but nevertheless, it was a institution which attracted a lot of bright people, a lot of competent people in the past. Young people you know, were keen to join the civil service because there was an element of prestige, social status, and the rest of it. The civil service was relatively independent, that the civil servants could do their job, and the politicians sort of respected that independence. Now, if we look at the period since 1971, I think if you look at the literature, you'll find that the institution of civil service has been politicized over the years. Particularly, I would say since 1991, it has been politicized, and because of this, it has lost its independence. It's lost its stature, and the recruitment of new people the quality of the people who are being recruited has dropped, and I think this has brought about a situation where now we find the civil service being controlled or dominated by the politicians, which wasn't the case, say, 20 years ago. It also means that the politicians that we have now are, you know, sort of were very much keen to have a civil service with which it can do business. You know, the politicians 20 years ago probably couldn't have done that because the civil servants wouldn't have allowed that kind of behavior, whereas now it is possible.
So can you just, what do you mean by do business?
By doing business, I mean that the politicians would abrogate their responsibility of taking decisions, and leave a lot of the decision making to the civil servants themselves, senior civil servants. So basically allowing them a lot of independence, and also reduce the level of accountability in terms of what they do. And in return, the politicians would negotiate deals, business deals with the bureaucracy, which would result in high level of corruption. So I think, I mean, when we talk about corruption, this is the kind of corruption which would be described as political corruption. This is the nexus, the relationship between the politicians and the bureaucracy, which results in grand corruption when it comes to, say, you know, when it comes to procurement, when it comes to infrastructure development, and we end up with the situation where the bureaucracy takes decision which would give them financial benefit, but also would give the politicians financial benefit. So it's a kind of a win-win situation from a kind of a corruption point of view. But at the end of the day, the country loses out. At the end of the day, the citizens lose out, particularly the poorer section of the community. So it's a kind of a collusive relationship that develops over a period of time. And when I talk about business, I'm basically talking about the rent-seeking which goes on, the so-called commission that people receives, and a lot of stories that we have heard of over the last few years vindicate that particular hypothesis.
And you say this started in 1991. Does the, do you think it's a return to democracy or particularly the parliamentary system that has caused this, or are there other factors?
I mean, I would say that there are other factors. I mean, I've already referred to the sort of falling of standards within the civil service. I mean, this is something that has not started in 1991. It started, you know, way back. Probably, if you have to take a date, probably 1971, when the administration had to be revamped and a lot of civil servants left, went back to Pakistan. A lot of civil servants actually left the country. A lot of people left the country. There was an exodus of middle-class people, you know, from Bangladesh. So this falling of standards, started to happen for quite some time. What we see happening from 1991 is the kind of the politicization of the institutions that I referred to. Together with the other factors, made the situation what it is now. The politics, the parliamentary form of politics, which was supposed to bring about a higher degree of accountability, instead of that, I think what we have found is that the independence of institutions have been undermined, the accountability factor has been weakened, and I think the general public have been receiving a poorer quality of public service from the service delivery institutions, like, for example, the judiciary, the police, the land registry offices, the public utility offices, and the other institutions which are involved in public service delivery.
So, in the past decade, have there been any major attempts at reform within administration and the civil service in Bangladesh?
If you look at the reports which have been published by the various public service reform commissions, you will find a lot of very appropriate and relevant recommendations. I mean, but when you look at the implementation record of those recommendations, it's actually very, very poor indeed. If you take the commission report, I think probably not more than six recommendations have been implemented, and even those are some very minor recommendations. So the track record is actually very, very poor indeed in terms of reform. A lot of commissions have been set up, a lot of reports have been published, but very little in terms of action.
So from my understanding of the reports and what I've seen, the reports appear to be quite good, with good analysis and sensible recommendations, but there seems to be very little willingness to implement them. Why do you think the government has been willing to appoint commissions that are going to produce these reports if they have no intention of implementing them? And am I correct that it's no intention of implementing? It's a lack of intent rather than a lack of ability to implement the reports.
I think it's mainly lack of intention. I think there's also an element of a lack of ability which is also there. But my feeling is that this exercise of appointing commissions and getting reports done is a bit of a window dressing, which would satisfy both the domestic demand for change and also the donor demand for change. You know, it's a convenient way of kind of diverting attention. Let's set up a commission. Let's get a report. Let's have a debate on the report, and then a few years down the road, no one will sort of think about it, and it will die a natural death. I think that has been the strategy, really. And again, I think that you know, a lot of these reports are also done in such a way that it doesn't really generate a lot of ownership within the stakeholders. You know, they remain as academic exercises, and not really. I don't think can really be described as a very practical exercise in terms of identifying doable, reform measures, which are thought through, with enough resources allocated to these reform measures. So basically, it remains an academic exercise. It's not a practical exercise. And on top of that, as we have discussed earlier on, the political will is not there. So it becomes a kind of exercise which is carried out by a handful of people, and then the report finally gathers dust on some government shelf.
What sort of ways do you think could be used to produce the political support for reform, sort of force the government's hand?
I think over the last 10, 15 years, particularly over the last 10 years, I think one of the interesting developments that we have seen in Bangladesh is the role of the civil society and the media. If you take, say, the example of governance, certainly, you know, governance, not just in Bangladesh, but in other countries too, it's become a very important topic. You know, but in Bangladesh, you will find that a lot of local organizations, media, both electronic and print, they have actually taken up this issue very, very seriously. This has resulted in tremendous public awareness in terms of some governance issues, particularly the level of corruption that we have in Bangladesh. Because of this enhanced awareness on the part of the public, I feel that this has generated a kind of a demand and also quite a bit of pressure, which has forced the politicians to at least talk about these issues. And in some cases, we also see some changes being undertaken, right? I must say that the pace of the change is still pretty slow, but nevertheless, I think over the last few years we have seen a lot of change, particularly over the last 2 years when we have had the caretaker government of Dr. Fakhruddin Ahmad. Many people would say that, you know, the government was a kind of, in a way, a civil society government, and a lot of civil society members were involved both in terms of the running of the government and also in terms of providing policy input from outside, and as we know, I mean, a whole range of new laws were put together. Altogether, around 130, approximately 130 new statutes. And if you look at these statutes, you'll find that a lot of them are to do with the subject of governance. You know, how institutions can be strengthened, and how they can be made independent and more accountable. And a few examples, for example, that I can cite: the Anti-Corruption Commission, the Public Service Commission, the separation of the lower judiciary from the executive, and many more. So yes, I mean, changes have taken place, but that change has happened due to tremendous public pressure on politicians. Whether this change will be sustained over the coming years is something that is, you know, is yet to be seen.
Right, do you have anything else to add before we finish?
I think probably what I would like to add is, from my own personal point of view, I've been involved with the issue of governance since 1996, and I certainly feel that that Bangladesh has moved forward in terms of governance, and I think what is holding us back at this point in time is not a lack of new ideas, but I think it's the lack of far-sighted political leadership that is holding us back, and if we can actually address this issue. And this is a political issue. I mean, this is something which cannot be generated in a laboratory. If this particular issue can be addressed, and I'm optimistic that Bangladesh will be able to address this, then I think we have a very, very bright future.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.